is it's letting them express themselves as who they truly are. These are creative people. They have this creative spark, no different from anybody else. If you have that, then you need to express it. And the thing that Project Grow does is it makes that possible for people where they would have had a lot of challenges otherwise. They help them with materials and with working, getting materials and working with materials and techniques. But they also, and this is something I appreciate about them, is that they also bring sort of this ethic of, we're going to let the people that are working here in the studio drive their projects. Like, they don't really step in and try and make them do it one way or another. And the reason I know this is because, like I said, L, he likes to do things with a lot of detail and minutia, and sometimes the approach that he takes to getting to a certain endpoint creatively is not necessarily the approach that anybody would take, because maybe he doesn't know about certain materials that are available in order to achieve a certain effect. So like I said, he takes what he's got and he figures out how to turn that into what he wants it to be. And he could be starting with some really random materials, but he just doesn't really know that there's other stuff that's sort of the like, say for instance, paper mache. He wouldn't necessarily know that paper mache would be the material to use for what he's trying to do. So Project Grow's role, from my perspective, has been to provide people with that paper mache, show them how to use that paper mache. But if they really don't want to use that paper mache, well, that's fine. They don't really try to force anything on them. They just, it's very kind of open and free flowing, and are just a really wonderful atmosphere there. I sense that the people that are part of Project Grow are really delighted to be there and getting a lot out of it. And this is the type of place where you don't necessarily see a benefit for somebody that's coming there in the short term, but think about the long-term benefits of just their mental health, and long-term just physical health, and how mental health and physical health play upon each other and that kind of a thing. So it's a very deep project.
It's wonderful. Yeah, I was impressed with that too when I saw the short time I was there. Laura, you have a little bit more information about that. When you were talking to the folks that are there, that are mentoring and or sharing, or their mentors, I suppose you could call it, did you also get that impression of, because while we were there, there was just people floating all over the place, picking up something here and something there and going back to the table and creating and then coming over and, yeah.
You could feel the creativity in the air. I mean, it felt really rather lifting to be in there, to be around there, to see how everything kind of flows. It's very much like any other social art project where you get a group of people together and you get a rhythm and a flow, and that was evident, very evident in this place, Project Grow. And I think we left with a feeling of just true joy to see that that was available. And that it, you know, a place like that exists.
There was stark raving kindness all over the place.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, and their art studio is amazing. How long does anybody know how long that's? I think they're just now starting to pull that art studio together, and that's got some enormous potential because they're going to use it as to hang art from the folks themselves, their clients, if you will. And some of that art is amazing because they had the canvases and they had a lot of it piled up and ready, you know, to be hung and whatnot. But then they're also going to open up that art studio for other artists to hang things. So it's got enormous potential. And yeah. Does anybody know about the funding around that? Because I think that's part of what we were going to talk about. Do you have any idea about? I know they had just gotten a grant, so they're up and running. And how many people were they serving? About 45 when we were there, something like that, if I recall.
We'll have to ask those questions when they're here next month.
Yeah.
They had. I thought it was about 45, and of course, now how many developmentally disabled that could benefit from this are out here in the city of Portland, just the city itself. So the expansion obviously is necessary with more grant money, more, and of course, you know, always looking for the money to do good things for good projects like this. So,
yeah, Laura was talking about that creative spark that exists there, and I had an opportunity to really experience what that means to somebody. Another guy, I believe, if I remember his name right, I'm going to refer to him as R. Hopefully R is listening. And R has some challenges communicating with people verbally. And I had come in, you know, occasionally visiting L while he's in the studio there, just because I like to connect with him sometimes just randomly. And sometimes we'd be meeting to go and do things. So I'd be in there time and again and getting to know R, really friendly guy. But again, we have some challenges in getting to know each other. So, you know, it's one of those situations again where I'm like, who is this guy? You know, what's going on with him? I don't really know. And it takes a while. But the thing that happened between R and I was he has this, it's kind of like a loom in a little bit. He does this giant weaving that's on a wall. I mean, it's like 10 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, there was these strings hanging on some kind of a contraption there. And he's weaving, you know, pieces of shirts and jeans. It looked like it was fabric. Mm-hmm. And he's weaving and weaving away. And it's a very intensive project that he's doing. And for the longest time, I would look at the wall and I would just be like, well, I don't know what this guy's doing, but he seems to be enjoying it okay, you know? Well, then all of a sudden, one day, I came in there and I looked at the wall and I could see the picture that he was making. And he had laboriously woven in all these colors. And what it was a picture of, at least this is what I saw. And Ari, hopefully one day you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed very clear to me that it was a picture of downtown with the skyscrapers or the buildings and then the river. And just the way that he had done it, he had just really, all of a sudden, poof, out of what seems to be really nothing, he's just painstakingly. And so, you know, I got to, and I was, hey, I see it. And then, you know, that gave us a bond, that gave us a connection. And, you know, that's what Project Grow and other things, you know, that's what they're really doing for people, is they're allowing them to be themselves and connect with other people. And, you know, just think for a moment how lonely it can be to have some communication challenges. And it's really actually hard to grasp the challenges and the effect that it has on people's lives to just live on anything approaching a normal life. If, say, for instance, you just really can't communicate with people through speech, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all we're working with right here, right now on KBOO is speech. And it's such a big part of our ability to connect with each other. And some people just really don't have that. And then here comes along places like Project Grow that are allowing, you know, this was his, he was able to speak to me with this project that they had facilitated him doing. You know, they let him have the time and the space as long as he needed to do what he needed to do. And then one day, boom, there you go. And it's just like, hey, all right. And a lot of that happens at Project Grow. You know, that's just one instance.
Yeah, and even we who are looked upon as being able to speak have challenges, let alone people that obviously have challenges. And another thing I was thinking about when it comes to the art, because I'm a poet, a writer, but also an artist, and I'm taking this course out of Chicago, The Value of the Artist, and artists are oftentimes, at least all the subject matter that we're studying is, artists are oftentimes a subset of communities anyway, in mainstream community, engineering and architecture and data and teaching and PhDs, and that tends to be more looked on by society as the legitimate way to express and make a living and contribute to society than the subset artists that all over the world that are struggling to become more mainstream and more accepted in their artwork, in the various forms of artwork. And then there's this subset to the subset that are in fact kind of taken
part social worker, part artist, almost. Mm-hmm. You know, taking the problems in society and exposing them for what they are, trying to get solutions to these problems. A lot of the people I work with are very hands-on. This is a very practical approach, and I think that social art will be the is the future. I think it will be the thing that makes society continue, allows society to continue. Excuse me, I'm getting tongue-tied.
It's okay.
but I really do believe it's the future, and it will solve a lot of the world's problems if we all work together. This is just models of how we can do that, and then making the models happen. And that's a lot of what social art is about.
Yeah, in my studies, I believe that creative expression is a given. I think we're all hardwired to be creatively expressive, and it just comes out in all sorts of ways. And then for people such as the, and see, for me, people like this, people that are we call them.
If I may, just jump in here real quick. I'd like to just say a brief note about this terminology.
Yeah.
So it's very empowering.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, the phrase that I use is people with developmental disabilities.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the most empowering way that I can that I've discovered yet to really sort of portray to other people what's going on. And mm-hmm. it kind of reminds mm-hmm. me that these are people, and they have a certain set of faculties, as do we all. Yes. There's certain things that none of us can do. And it's important to just remember that they are people and they do have things going on, needs and capabilities that it's worth remembering. They're people. And so, for instance, we could say people with a heart condition.
Exactly.
Or people with brown skin or people with long hair. These are just ways to describe the fact that all we're dealing with here is people, and mm-hmm. and I like that terminology. I like to advocate for that type of terminology, because the effects of using that type of language might not be apparent until it's you that somebody's talking about. And if they don't refer to you as a person and they refer to you as a condition or some other descriptor, then mm-hmm. they're missing the point, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I'm 70, so I'm an old elder. I'm an elder.
Person with a person massive with experience.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. I'm taking you with me, and we're going to announce that every time I go on my buggy, because I'm treated as a sort of an invisible elder now. So it's okay. I can handle it, but we're part of what our work, I think this social art and the work you're doing, Jimmy, and the work I'm doing, so on. I write around these issues. I write around social justice issues and so on, around all of these issues. And I think we as artists, in our various ways, are taking these messages out sort of as gently and as kindly and yet strongly as possible to try to change attitude. And I think KABU is very, I'm very grateful to be at a KABU, Mike, because this is basically what KABU does. We give voice to the voiceless, and
hear, hear.
And we give voice to issues that the general public doesn't have sort of time to address. I mean, people are busy, they're working, they're stressed, they're trying to make money, we're trying to survive. But these are special, special artists. They really, in a way, they're almost special artists. I see the artwork over there almost being so special that it really needs to be exposed on a bigger field, which is where I see social art coming in, mm-hmm. More of a worldwide field. Anyway, we're all working on that, right?
Yes, we are.
So I want to do a little break here, and I want to do, we're KABU. This is Disability Awareness, fourth Monday of every month, 11 o'clock in the morning. It's call-ins are welcome. Guests are welcome, so email me at grace_eagle@hotmail.com if you want to be a guest, you have issues, whatever. Observer, and the Observer is United States, it's all over the world. The Observer magazine or online magazine is announced over 1 billion people are disabled in this world, in the world we're living in. That means 15% of the world's population is disabled. I thought that was rather interesting. So we have a lot of work to do around that issue with the various kinds of disablement. There's also an announcement on April the 6th, 2014, of course, at the Roseland Theater from 2 to 5, there is a seminar. It's a free medical marijuana educational symposium for patients with multiple sclerosis. And I don't see a website here, but I do have a phone number, 503-297-9544. So if you're interested in that on April the 6th, call them and sign up and go for that. Okay, so we've got a few minutes to talk a little bit more about possibly what are some of the solutions, what are some of the strategies that we all want to use perhaps to get the bigger picture out and equalize. I get a feeling we need to equalize ourselves as humans, and that is starting to happen, that unity process, that process of all of us coming together, trying to understand each other in a state of kindness and intelligence, I suppose. But what are some thoughts, especially with, you're going to New York pretty soon with your project.
I am. I'm going to Open Engagement 2014, and I'm very excited. Open Engagement is directed by Jen De Los Reyes, and she's amazing. She's an amazing leader, very creative, and really knows how to make things happen. And she has been doing this for about 6 years, and I've been working with Open Engagement for 3 years now. I'm actually on the housing committee, so I get to place artists in housing in the Queens area. But what I should say before I even mention that is it started here at Portland State, mm-hmm. and has been so successful that it was moved to the Queens Museum in New York. So I'm part of that process of moving over there, very excited to be part of it in every aspect. And these are the people who are going to change the world. These are the people who are trying to make different models or better models or at least expose some of the issues that are out there that people really need to take a look at. There's just so many different things you can do with social art. It's really amazing. It's going to be a work-life theme, and I'll be presenting my zine on Guantanamo Bay. And I'll be working hard, too, but it is very, very exciting.
While you're at the mic, tell us a little bit more about your zine and you know, I've seen it, and I know you were a Gitmo gal, and there was a lot of stuff going on there. And
yes, certainly. Well, just to be brief, I worked on a project with Sarah Merck and Lucy Bellwood to produce originally it was an online magazine on SymboliaMag.com, and it was about my story coming from the Middle East as a civilian, joining the Navy, and after training being sent to Guantanamo Bay, and just a couple months after that they started sending detainees down there. So this was 2002, January 2002, and I got to see what the base was like before that happened, and during that time a lot of conflict for me personally about it. But this piece that Sarah Merck and Lucy Bellwood did with me have enabled me to talk about it more, and has actually given me more life and ability to do the other works I like to do, like the social art. Mm-hmm. So this is an amazing opportunity to get to present that in New York.
So there's one artist making changes, and identifying certain issues and that are still ongoing.
Yes.
I'll announce. So, Jimmy, what are you up to these days in your field? Are you still mentoring for Project Grow? Or?
Well, I'm not necessarily a mentor for Project Grow. I'm a life coach for adults with developmental disabilities. So what I do is basically accompany people, provide them some companionship while they're out learning about the world and how to be more independent in the world. That's what it boils down to.
And how many people do you work with?
You know, typically when I'm working, I'm working one-on-one with someone.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times we also do group things just to kind of, you know, that's part of life is doing things with a group. So...
And I know you were my field recording teacher, so I'm very excited about doing some field recording because I'm a 70-year-old lady in a scooter most of the time, and so I could take my little field recorder and go out there. And there's a lot of folks that can be reached that are disadvantaged, oppressed, marginalized. Confused, lonely, fearful. You know, there's so many people that are just not in the mainstream.
And that's another thing that KBOO does is not only do we have a studio space for people to come to and make their voices heard, but we'll come to you and, you know, maybe wherever you are in the moment, in your place of doing what it is you do, sort of help people express themselves and what's going on and what they need to say.
And I also do senior activism. I'm over at City Hall a lot of the time. I have a KBOO pass, by the way. Thank you, Kathleen. And oftentimes I'm over there with HAP HUD issues. In fact, there's a big one that's just come up. It's on the news now. This lady in Happy Valley has been displaying the American flag in her window for 6 years. And then suddenly Cascade Management, which is a management company that HAP and HUD, HAP, Housing Authority Portland, which is also called Home Forward, uses as a management system, suddenly got busy about giving her a very punitive eviction notice, get the flag down after it's been up there 6 years. So this is the kind of thing that's there's an injustice around it. There's not even any sanity around it. And I get involved, and this grandmother is a handicapped grandmother. So, and we've had, even in our building, we've had several incidences. I've had people rush into my apartment looking for bed bugs. I don't have them. And literally going to my bed and tearing the bed apart, flipping mattresses, going right down to the floor on their hands and knees looking for bed bugs. And here's all my bedding, my mattresses, everything. So the strategies that are used in HAP housing are questionable. And so we need a lot of help with a lot of things. So if you want to know, there's a lot of stuff to cover around these issues. If you want to know anything more about my work, it's Grace Eagle at, negotiatingshadows.com is the website. Any way to reach you if you want to be reached?
I'm available on Facebook, Laura Sandow.
And Jimmy, any?
Yeah, I have a blog. It's called, it's all one word, funisgoodforyou.blogspot.com, where you can see pictures of me doing what I get to do.
And this is our show. Thank you, people, for listening, and we will see you next month. Thank you very much, and thank you, my guest, for coming to the mic today.
Thank you, Grace.
Thanks.
By being alive, you change the world. You change the world by being alive. By being alive, you change the world. You are the world. You are alive.
You're already qualified to help us change the world. Join us at our next volunteer orientation on Monday, April 7th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, here at your community radio station, KBOO.
Yeah, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In this series, we feature conversations with people who have special insights about health topics as diverse as environmental hazards, new and old medical treatments, and the benefits of universal healthcare. Sometimes we present an informal talk or even a lecture. Doing this program has enriched my life, and I hope it enriches yours. Last week, our forum introduced Peter Goodman, a private practice therapist in Albany, Oregon, who specializes in working with children. We learned how a child therapist, who works with children age 4 and older, views his work and uses play to help a child work through developmental issues and other things that disturb them. Peter also discussed what children need from parents to help them successfully meet the many challenges that everyone faces in growing up in our demanding culture. This second part of the program discusses some specific difficulties that appear when more serious threats to a child's well-being emerge, whether these are from within the family or from society at large.
And I would just say that one of the most important things is to try to enjoy your child, that parenting is so difficult. It would be an impossible job if one really didn't enjoy being with that child. But the child only has one need, and that's for parents who love her and will do best by her. We all fail to various degrees at being parents, but if the failure is sincere, then it works, and it's good enough. And occasionally it really fails and it isn't good enough. And when I see children like that who've been sexually abused or physically abused and that whole spectrum of difficulties, then something profound has been rent in the fabric of a child's life that's very difficult to put together. It really is a disaster for children. But the odd thing is, more often than your listeners would imagine, those children long for their parents. They want their parents to be loving. They want their parents to be available. They want their parents to be there, even while there is incontrovertible evidence that they've been treated terribly. It just shows you how much children need those fundamental qualities we've been talking about. And so being with a child who has been traumatized is a whole nother problem for the adult to be able to make contact with that child in a positive way. Now, the thing that I always hear when I'm out socially and people say, oh, you're a child therapist. Oh my gosh, how do you do that work because you're seeing so many really troubled little kids? Well, it is difficult and it is serious work, but at the same time, I'm not doing it alone. I'm doing it with the child. I'm doing it with parents, hopefully. And the child does the work. I help with that work. And the main thing is I'm not just looking at it. I'm not just observing these battered children. I'm actually helping them transcend their experience and move forward in their lives.
Wonderful. Let's talk just a minute about preventive concepts. That's a big, big thing in healthcare these days, you know. Just in terms of you go to a physician occasionally and they go through a checklist again, how much do you smoke or do you smoke and how much alcohol do you drink and have you had your flu shot this year? Please tell me you've had your flu shot. All that sort of thing in the physical biological component of it. Is there a preventive sort of thing or should schools have observations? You know, oftentimes during school, the school year, children are measured and weighed, and
those records are kept, and sometimes tests are done, and those scores are kind of kept, and people mull over them. Is there a mental health or emotional health component to that?
I think our society is still coming to terms with the idea that children can be disturbed enough to be labeled mentally ill. It's something that sort of goes against our whole sentimental idea that children are a fresh breeze and that life is good. And in fact, oftentimes life is good. But as we talked about earlier, children do fall ill. You could use that kind of model, or do have difficulties and so forth. But usually it's because, as I said before, it's inconvenient for someone else. And schools do pick up the inconvenient child, the child that doesn't fit into the routinized situation of schools. That child may not actually be ill and may be, in fact, very healthy, but it's the inconvenient child that is picked up. The quiet, slightly depressed girl in the back of the class is probably never going to see a counselor. But the guy that stands up on top of the chair and throws erasers at the teacher is going to be singled out for some kind of action. And that action is often so cursory. Medication, we haven't talked about that. But, you know, we live in America, the quick fix. So give the child some medication, keep them calm. We have an enormous number of children who are medicated because school have picked up a problem.
Well, you know, some of our classrooms are 30, 35 kids in them. And when one is acting out, it would be a difficulty for the classroom teacher. And what is that classroom teacher going to do?
Well, there's a number of things that happen. If the child is fortunate and the teacher is sensitive and the institution is prepared to cope with an inconvenient child, as we've been calling her or him, then things can be done to support